Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Agnes DeMille hired dancers who act.
Mm-hmm.
She did. And she also hired men and women who didn't have the stereotypic dancer body.
Mm.
They weren't heavy, but the women did have shapes.
They had some shape.
And the men were not all tall and lanky. And what they had... And they all were astounding dancers, but they looked like people.
Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional impact of some of our favorite musicals in theater history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons. You can call me Jeff. Today, we are discussing the musical Brigadoon with someone, and this is me casually dropping the mic here, who was Tony nominated for it? Yes, as Fiona McLaren, she was Tony nominated for Best Performance by a Leading Actress in a Musical. She has an upcoming performance on September 6th at 54 Below as part of the all-star lineup for Charles Kirsch's Backstage Babble Live, who, by the way, is a fellow podcaster. She's also an amazing educator. I'm so thrilled she's here. Everyone, please welcome Meg Bussert.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here. I do have to have one caveat here. I was Fiona in the 1980 revival. Not the
just
1947 original. That did come up a few times.
That is a fair clarification. I mean, that would just be full miracle. If you were in the 47 production, then that means you went into Brigadoon. And this is the one day where you have come back.
Yes.
yes, thank you for the clarification. The 1980s revival, which is, thanks to you, I did not know this, is all on YouTube. And it's really a lovely recording. I don't know who snuck their camera into that theater, but it looks great.
And it's been there for a while. I think it's there because it's a part of history, because it was never recorded in any other fashion. And it really captures the Agnes DeMille choreography, which is stunning.
Yes.
And I
absolutely
think that's the reason. It's a research thing, kind of.
You're absolutely right. It's such a great tool and window into our history. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on. It's really such an honor for me. We've covered a couple of Lerner and Lowe shows on the podcast, Camelot, My Fair Lady, and I highly recommend our listeners to go back and listen to those if they haven't. But this is the first time we're covering an L&L with someone who performed them on the Broadway and perhaps knew them? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about your relationship with Lerner and Lowe and how Brigadoon came along.
So mostly with Alan J. Lerner. My equity card came into my life when I ran away from the Midwest. I was something like 4 points shy of my degree, but ran out of money. And I came to New York to be the next Julie Andrews, you know, but that was the plan.
I mean, congratulations, because I would say success.
Yeah, so I actually went back and got several degrees later, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I finished and went on, but that's why I ended up teaching at NYU. Anyway,
So
my equity card came with that wonderful show, Lolita, My Love, which is a musical version, John Barry and Alan J. Lerner musicalizing Nabokov's Lolita.
Perfect, isn't it? Perfect.
I mean, musical. Why on earth would we want to see a musical about teenage rape? But like, I was
21. I got in the chorus. In those days, it was very strong chorus. You know, singers and dancers. You know, you didn't
sure.
do one other thing. You stayed in your little thing. But it was. I learned so much, and we had two horrible out-of-town tryouts, and then they came back and rewrote and tried to do it. It failed, and it shouldn't. We were in either Boston or Philadelphia, the two big tryout towns, and there was a place called the Variety Club, which stayed open for singers and dancers. Anybody doing a show in these wonderful tryout towns. It was catered to the theater people, so there might be two or three shows trying out at the same time. Anyway, Alan would go, and so would John Barry, and they would sit there, and they were very approachable. We would sit there, you know, and I mean, we were all gobsmacked. And
of course, you know, royalty.
I grew up listening to all the vinyls, and I knew all the things, and I think I had done a really terrible production of For the Dune in high school, I'm sure, because I had stories to talk. Anyway, he would sit there.
We might
there.
Have that in common. Continue.
He would tell stuff. He would tell stories and remind me, because I have something he told me specifically about Brigadoon. I had a Brigadoon question, just because I had this question. He answered me, and it was an astounding, informative thing that happened later. So anyway, I knew him from that. The next thing I encountered him in was the Brigadoon. And then Camelot a year later and worked with him on that.
That was just a year later.
It was about a year and a half later. It was something like that.
With Richard Harris,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. And then I did a PBS salute to Alan J. Lerner. I came on and sang a song from Brigadoon with Richard White. So those are like four. Oh, and then there was this backers audition for Teddy and Alice, which was...
Yes,
and Alan was kind of producing that kind of quietly. We did 3 years of the backers audition. Brilliant music written to John Philip Sousa, borrowed from that, and it was musically so much fun. By the time they capitalized it, they decided I was too old to play Alice, so they hired someone else, and it flopped, and I was so sad. So they then decided to record it, and they called me to come in and sing, because So anyway,
So
I got to know him on a nice personal. He was a brilliant man. The way he could handle lyrics has always astounded me. Listening to how the many levels that he would write for, and he was always very generous. You couldn't not do it right. You know, if you had a different take, you might get a little note. I think you should try this, or I really appreciated that. And when he would come in and check on the show, I would always get a note back. Meg, I can understand every word. And I was like,
generous.
One of the few brilliant, brilliant, we have a lot of brilliant composers, but he was up there at a time, you know, with Lorenz Hart and
all of them.
Cole Porter. And they all knew each other. They all worked together. They all respected each other. So it was truly a community of creatives.
Wow. And I mean, at this point, Frederick Lowe didn't have much to do with him anymore, right?
Right. Yes, he did. I think he was on top of it a little bit. There was, for Brigadoon particularly, there was going to be a bit of rewriting. And that, of course, he was also the librettist. And so when Vivian Madelon came in, Vivian being the Meisner,
the director,
had so many questions as to some of the buildups and some of the storytelling aspects that... The storytelling was a little bit different. It was beginning to be brilliant. It was brilliant in the 40s, but compared to where it went, those were the beginnings.
The art form, how it had evolved, for
and
sure.
And so Vivian coming at it 20 years later is going, this could be better, And so actually Alan did give him permission. When he made some changes, it was kind of understood that Alan didn't like it, but it was okay. Do you know what I mean? He was going to let it go because he understood... A new look at it. He was open enough for that, but it was interesting because the day he came to see the show, he came back to talk to all of us, and we were, does he like it? And
right.
We don't know.
Poker face.
He never told us.
Interesting. How cool. I find this period of musical theater really interesting, the early 80s. Specifically with revivals, because it seems like we were all trying to grapple with our sense of history and what was really popular in Broadway's heyday. And how does that apply to a new audience? Do we just presented exactly as it was before to try and capture that magic? Do we revive it in a revisal sort of way? It really is the transitionary period between let's just do Pajama Game like we've always done Pajama Game, and in the 90s when we really start seeing true revisions at musicals.
Yeah, I think you're right. The questions started coming up in the 70s. And the other thing that was going on was the youth musical, the rock musical. And,
sure.
And the traditionalists were like shocked. You know, what kids loved it. You know, I mean, we all loved it. We thought it was great fun. And we did think that when we were doing a revival, it was a bit old-fashioned, you know, but, you know, it was kind of can't beat some of that singing if you were, you know, storytelling maybe wasn't as deep as you might have wanted it, but it was there. So it was there mm-hmm. to be discovered. And then you could say some of the more contemporary pieces at the time were not actually brilliant stories either, but they were a reflection of the enthusiasm and the other look, the new look.
That's a really good point. It's more emotional than maybe plot heavy or plot driven.
Right. You know. What was that one? Hamlet? Rockabye Hamlet. That was that.
Rockabye Hamlet.
I'm a big Shakespearean maven. I discovered Shakespeare in seventh grade, and I think that's one of the reasons why, as an actor singer, I was always more interested in the words than the music. You know, when I went to teach in college, I was not teaching voice; I was teaching acting, and acting without song, because I knew that young acting singers needed to understand acting and needed to be able to what an actor does into the complications of music and dance.
And interpreting the text within all of that.
Yeah, that's and Shakespeare cool. kind of did it. He sort of wrote it. You know, he wrote it. And if you can handle a speech of Shakespeare, you can handle a musical song. It's fine.
Ooh, that is a great quote. I'm stealing it.
I have a little workshop that I could give you. I do. I put that together. Yes.
That would be incredible.
It's working on a Shakespeare monologue and then taking a solo Shakespeare song.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, the structure and the argument. Like, ooh. Will he like me when we meet? Oh, that's a great one with a Shakespeare monologue. Or could be, who knows, there's something due any day. Another great one. Shakespeare.
I just got chills. We mentioned She Loves Me, everybody. Hey, listeners, have you tried Factor yet? Remember Factor Meals? They were supposed to send me a box to try out, but they don't ship to Hawaii, so now I'm stuck with my Taco Bell. And now it's up to you. It's up to you to try it and let me know how it is, because it's May, and we can't eat like it's the holidays anymore. We're trying to get our summer bodies together, and Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So, no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great-tasting food. You can choose from 6 menu preferences to help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, whatever you want, it's here. Head to factormeals.com/musicaltheater50, that's musical theater with an ER, and use code musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code musicaltheater50 at factormeals.com/musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. All right, so Brigadoon, I know we haven't covered Oklahoma yet on the podcast, which seems crazy, but there are just some monumental shows that I want to save for the future, and that's one of them. But Brigadoon is, I feel like, really, really proof of just how monumental Oklahoma was.
Mm-hmm.
Lerner and Lowe had written 3 shows prior to Brigadoon. The first closed before it ever got to Broadway. The second and third were met with okay success, but I couldn't tell you a thing about them. And then Oklahoma hits, and it's almost like being in love. No, just kidding. It's almost like they unlocked the secret to what would become musical theater.
Oh,
and
yes.
And I know this is when people start throwing around subgenres like musical play and musical comedy. But for the sake of this podcast, I'm just calling it musical theater. Anyway, so Lerner and Lowe aren't stupid. They see what works about Oklahoma and apply it to what they bring to the art form. And that's kind of the birth of Brigadoon.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think some of their hallmarks are, having lived in both Camelot and Brigadoon?
Lerner especially was fascinated with other than this time and other than this place.
Brigadoon actually comes from, I believe, a German legend. Hmm. It might be even the Celtic Germania, whatever it was. You know, there was a Celtic thing.
People connect
with Irish and Scottish, but it was all over Northern
Europe.
So anyway, this was one of those stories. And, you know, you look at the story of Brigadoon, which is this town goes to sleep for 100 years and wakes up and lives one day. But in its time, which would have been in Brigadoon, it would have been, you know, 1747, the priest or the minister of the town is being overrun by demons, creatures of evil, and they're going to do in the town.
Yeah.
They're going to take them over, enslave them, or annihilate them. Something bad is going to happen, and it's not identified. But in order to save the town, the minister has to make a deal with God. And he just simply says, take me, I'm yours, and free my people, or whatever, protect them.
Save us, yeah.
So that, you know, we can connect that to a lot of stories we know, but that's what happens. So the minister goes off into the mountains and hills, disappears. Brigadoon is under a spell. It goes to sleep for 100 years. It wakes up again, I guess, in 1847.
Yeah.
And then it goes
It's still operating in this other time.
Yes, it's only 2 days later. And so that's the premise of it. So Camelot's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Camelot is a legend.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's true, some of it's not. A lot of it is, you know, but you're dealing again with, you know, the fairies and the Celtic kind of the magic and the mystery, which was terribly important. You know, and again, in Fair Lady, you're dealing with the transformation, you know, and, you know, but they're all, they challenge your imagination, all of the stories.
Yes,
and,
that's
and
a,
that
ooh, I love that.
Something that they really captured, and that's a lot of Mr. Lerner. He's just in there, anyway.
Wow.
So that's Lerner and Lowe.
Where do you? Because I never had a conversation with Mr. Lerner. Where does his prose come from? He's so famous for these types of songs that like "There But For You Go I" or "I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face" or "On the Street Where You Like These." Lyrics that I feel like no one else could write except for him. Is there a formality to his and a poetry that is very specifically his?
I think his love of words, his love of Anglophile, you know, I'm sure Shakespeare and Gilbert and Sullivan had a lot to do with a lot of the cleverness of what he did. But I think the songs express a deep human emotion, and he allows his characters to really get pissed if the actor-singers will do that because "I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face," which is a lovely, sweet song, starts with damn, 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 damn.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, where do we and, go from there?
Yeah, and "There But For You Go I" starts with Fiona, and the way it was originally done, you know, "Do you know, Tommy, that you're all I'm living for?" Very sweet, very whatever. And then we decided through Vivian's working that she's pissed.
Mm.
She's finally found someone. And he's going to go, how dare you? So they actually changed the orchestration. I'm like, give me a no, Tommy. You know, just
screaming
at him.
Wow, just giving you.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that gave him, I mean, it was there. It just, that wasn't how they presented it in, you know, 47. Probably didn't want Soprano screaming.
Sure.
I don't know. But I didn't mind. you know, and that pushes Tommy into no. I will never forget you because I was lost. I was on the verge of committing suicide. I was whatever.
Yeah.
I was not going to be able to live. I don't know what's facing me when I go home, but I know I can't stay here.
Wow.
And that's all he's saying. But all of those songs have, you know, in Brigadoon, when she comes out, where are the simple joys of maidenhood?
Yeah, in Camelot.
Where's the knight's killing me? Where's the knight pining so for me? He leaps to death. I mean, every girl should have that. You know, and it's so brilliant. You know, she's 15 years old. She's been so closed up, protected. He gives voice or he gives words to the marvelous human imagination. And yes, I think maybe that was one of the things that got me cast is because I never came in as a blonde little soprano.
Mm-hmm.
I always came in with, I'm the oldest of seven children, and I came in with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am truly the, I mean, there was a lot of noise in my family. And, you know, we were all good people, but boy, we could be noisy with it. And I think that, you know, that works well for so many of those women written in the 40s and 50s. They were very strong women. But
Well, I got to give you a compliment because I watched your performance. And first of all, you sound glorious. Like, it just sounds like that's where you live. Like, walking around in comfy house slippers in this soprano role. And then you do have this strength that is so important, I think, for younger generations to see that singing a soprano role does not mean not being strong, or singing beautifully does not mean that you are apologetic for your stage presence. It really is kind of a masterclass. So,
well, thank you. But it's also in singing the old song, the old shows, mm-hmm. doesn't mean you're any less strong. You know, when I was teaching, that my students constantly, oh, one of the old things. And I said, yeah, okay, so show me what's inside. One of the old things. Do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, really, I can do that? Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah.
So it's terribly important to, again, it's an actor thing, and both Vivian and when, especially when I was working on Camelot with Harris, because he wasn't the easiest person, shall we say, I was far too energetic for him, because I was American. I was basically American, and he wanted something else. But I think we were told by others that it was our frustration made it work. You know what I mean?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at least you had some sort of fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it wasn't we disliked each other, but I could see I was frustrating him, and I just wasn't going to change. So
nothing more Gwenny.
In a nice way. But so I learned from those shows, I think, a lot about the energy that's inside that doesn't have to come out. Because as you can see from, we're talking now, and you're looking at me being a little energetic when I talk. That comes out in all of my work initially. And then you find how you can put that inside. I did a lot of work studying the Michael Chekhov work, approach to acting. And he's very physical and imaginative. And one of the tools is the psychological gesture, where you work out, you know, the gesture of what you really want to do physically with the material. And then you put it all inside, which is something actors do all the time.
Ooh.
So I was sitting on top of all of my energy, and it literally drove me crazy initially. And I would always be getting, yes, that's it. Yes, that's it. I said, but I'm going to go explode. That's good. And you should, but don't.
That's captivating. You know? And yeah.
So the audience reads that. They read that dynamism within you. And they interpret it in the story. They don't interpret it as, oh, Meg's going crazy today.
Right.
She really wants to jump and scream. They say, oh, Marion's really upset about this situation. Guinevere's, you know, about to explode. Or, you know, whatever the character might be. They interpret it within the story.
This is so cool. I love when episodes surprise me, and I hadn't expected this tie to almost the classical nature of this show, which is surprising because I do feel like this is a piece of classical musical theater. But what a beautiful opportunity for us to see how much is inside these older pieces.
Oh, it's stunning. And here's a line, and I think that's what, you know, Hammerstein learned from his father. Hammerstein did all this stuff. Hammerstein taught Sondheim. Sondheim taught Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, we can go and find so many links that, you know, you do pass on. They do pass things on. And whether you want to do it or not, you have to recognize the art and the craft.
It's a beautiful line. And the more I do this show, the more I'm just so grateful for it. So now going back to Oklahoma's influence on Brigadoon, and we've got like the serious romantic relationship between Fiona and Tommy. We'll also talk about the secondary one, which is kind of the Will Parker 80 Annie plotline. And but maybe most literally the thing that Lerner and Lowe took from Oklahoma was Agnes DeMille, who was the choreographer and maybe the reason Oklahoma was so groundbreaking, because this choreography that bridged the dramatic narrative with the music, with the acting. I mean, you can't overstate it. And she is also who originally staged Brigadoon and the revival that you did. So talk to me about Miss DeMille, how was she health-wise at this point?
She was about 72. She walked on she had a walker. It's a lot of injuries from her dancing days. And
sure.
Stuff. But she was so sharp, and she was amazing. The dancers, of course, rehearsed separately from us. So when they came in to show their stuff, we were all like, Ms. DeMille walked into the room and everybody got quiet.
Yeah.
everybody got reverent. To watched, you know, and it was, you know, I vowed at that time that when I was growing older, got to her age, I wanted to be eccentric and I wanted everyone to be quiet when I walked into the room. Now that didn't happen, but I did want to.
Did the eccentric happen?
Yeah, that happened, I think. Yeah, that's, yeah. Good point. But she, in Oklahoma, I think, and Hammerstein wasn't thrilled with her work initially, actually. First time he saw the Dream Valley, he went, why? And Agnes was, when she saw the show and she, you know, got to Kansas City, she could do all that, having the girls all dance in the beginning on Many New Day and all these kinds of things was fine. But she saw something in Laurie's situation. She saw something which was pretty strongly presented with Judd having a fixation on Laurie and, you know, what kind of sickness was that and how is Curly really going to handle it. And Curly doesn't get it until Curly walks into his shed. And then Curly goes, okay, we got a problem.
We got a problem.
Uh-huh. Other, you know, before that, he was just an obnoxious in the way guy. But right. Okay, he's a sicko. And, you know, I got an old lady and a young lady over here living next to them and they need some help. So this, all of this comes up. But she saw the confusion in Laurie, a young girl. So she created an imaginary out of my dreams, supposedly about she and Curly. But in her dreams, as we all dream, our psychology pops in. And the strangest things come to the foreground in our dreams that, why did I dream that? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what she wanted to present. So she presented a what if situation where Judd wins.
Mm.
A woman's perspective on what if she loses? What if the situation gets out of it? What if Curly can't save her? What if this guy wins? You know, and who are these dance hall girls? Are they, you know, the little devils that dance around? So she created this marvelous story, which initially the actors couldn't dance.
Sure.
So they had to have a, you know, stand in. So it became, the whole Dream Ballet became in her imagination, and it was astounding. In all of her work, she's consistent with taking something and then telling a story in the dance associated with the song, but not necessarily about the song.
About the song. Ooh, this is great. That is great.
You know, and so that was another element.
I mean, Agnes DeMille is so good at like clear and simple storytelling, and she uses a lot of repetition to do it, a lot of ballet technique, and then also surprisingly emotional dance vocabularies. All of a sudden, you'll see, I know we're like doing a visual medium right now. That's not helpful for the listeners. You'll see the dancer do some gesture that feels psychological, to use your word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a psychological manifestation of this emotional inner world. And it's this really iconic combination of simplicity, ballet, and then these surprising little pieces of vocabulary.
You know, as I was thinking about what we were going to talk about, to me, Vivian Madelon put together the acting, he put together the words, he directed the words, whether they were sung or spoken. She directed the dance. For example, Come to Me, Bend to Me.
Oh, freaking gorgeous.
Which he comes in and sings this glorious thing, and then she's saying, leave, you know, go away, I have to come out, you can't see me today. So he finally does leave, and then the women come out, and she comes out, and she has her little moment, and it's, she's surrounded by her, you know, her bridesmaids. Yeah, you know? They're all around there, and she's dancing within it. Again, it's a psychological expression of the fear of getting married, you know, loving this man. It's been a complicated thing because there was this other person who I kind of like. I don't hate him,
right,
but I don't love him. You know, so this is her. All that story is, that's what Agnes did. She told a psychological story that wasn't in the play.
Mm.
And by the time she got to Brigadoon, she was trusted enough, I guess, or strong enough, that she was able to take each one of these songs and then turn it around to a different story. So it wasn't him dancing with her about Come to Me, Bend to Me, or even him dancing alone. He gave the, I love you, I can't wait to see you, and why do I have to go away? Okay, I'll go. And then she comes out and dances. Well, she dances her feelings as opposed to making it a duet.
Hey, listeners, have you tried Factor yet? Remember Factor Meals? They were supposed to send me a box to try out, but they don't ship to Hawaii, so now I'm stuck with my Taco Bell. And now it's up to you. It's up to you to try it and let me know how it is, because it's May and we can't eat like it's the holidays anymore. We're trying to get our summer bodies together, and Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting food. You can choose from 6 menu preferences to help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, whatever you want, it's here. Head to factormeals.com/musicaltheater50, that's musical theater with an ER, and use code musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code musicaltheater50 at factormeals.com/musicaltheater50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. This has already been so amazing. Now, and we've already talked a lot about the plot, but let's actually go through the show. And I'll just give people who may not know what Brigadoon is all about, we'll go through the bones of it. So the show begins with two characters, Tommy and Jeff, and they're lost. They're lost. They can't figure out where they are. Jeff's fine with it. He's like, are you kidding me? What a beautiful place to be lost in. And Tommy, I feel like it's kind of triggering to him because he feels lost in his own life as well. And so, like, this is just too much. I'm literally lost and also feeling lost. He's engaged to a woman back in New York. By the way, we're in Scotland. I don't know if I mentioned that. Good heavens. Highlands. And as they're talking about this this feeling of unrest that he has, they hear this music growing, this chorus singing of Brigadoon. And slowly but surely, this town comes to life. And of course, we know that we've already discussed the magic of this town.
So shall I tell you my Alan J. Lerner? Are we at there now?
Yes, please, please.
Okay, so please. My question to Alan was, clearly, Tommy isn't assimilating in his life. He's unhappy. He's a romantic. A lot of different descriptions for him, but something's not right. Jeff is on his way to being an alcoholic.
And he's well on his way.
Yes. And so they're buddies, you know, and they take trips together. In the original, they were hunting, so they had guns. Mm. In the revival, they're hiking, so they had backpacks. Hmm. So that was a big change.
Wow.
But that worked. So it's no once in the Highlands, two weary hunters, two weary travelers lost their way. Hmm. That's the intro. So, but I said, why are Jeff and Tommy friends? They're just so different. And he said, oh, well, this was 1947. And, you know, World War II had only been over a couple of years. They were war buddies.
Wow.
And they were coming back. And like so many American young men, they were not able to assimilate.
Yeah.
Jeff is drinking to figure out his problems. Tommy is just kind of lost. He's engaged to a woman he doesn't really love, doesn't know. And all of a sudden he meets this energy. And Fiona is not a shy young woman. She's a very strong young lady. And he just is kind of blown away. So the fact that they were vets, you know, whether or not they were in the same, like my brain had Tommy being lieutenant and Jeff being the sergeant. I mean, that's sort of where I saw their energies.
Yeah.
But when that was explained, all of a sudden their bond became so, which is
why
Tommy
unlocks a piece, man, doesn't it?
Tommy can understand the alcoholism and he's there for his friend. Jeff understands. They both get each other. And as Alan J. Lerner said, he said the audience in 1947 got that too. It's nowhere in the script.
It's not there.
Nowhere there. So if you have that inside information and you're doing it now, if you update it, you know, it's okay. Kind of, you know, we did update it to 1980, so it was, you know, 1880. There was 1780 when it was happening. And that's kind of, yeah, that changed, like the American Revolution had already happened for the first time. It didn't, so, I mean, it changed a lot of little things that people actually thought about it much. But, but yeah, so the relationship between the two men is totally understandable.
That's huge. I had never considered that and really makes it so timely. Much more timely than I thought, because one of the hallmarks that I always think of with Lerner and Lowe is an element of magic or transformation.
Good word.
And so I just kind of maybe wrote it off a little bit as just fantasy and living in another time. But it is so intrinsically tied to the time in which it was written. When you look at it as being a post-war musical, that's incredible.
Right. And for us, it was Vietnam. So we had Vietnam going on. So that worked. Well, I mean, the same kinds of things were in place.
I love this so much. They were in the war together. You won't find that out in the script, people. And a beautiful opening number where we see the whole townsfolk and the economy of it, even. Everybody has their businesses. And I mean, if you could only live one day every 100 years, I think you would probably live with all of your heart. So these people feel very excited to be alive, to say the least.
Yes, they're very grateful that they are alive because of what they went through.
Now, I got to say, when I went through this preparing for the episode, the themes that popped out to me, and it may be because I've been spending so much time in Hawaii, is this idea of gentrification and preserving a place from change. Here on Maui, there's so much talk about tourism for better or worse and what it's done in terms of colonialization and hurting the original cultures and people of this island. And I don't know, when going through Brigadoon, that just felt very, very singular, that here's this place that has decided to protect itself completely from outside forces. And what are the consequences of it, good or bad?
Well, some of them, if I can jump in, consequences for the young folk, for the first one you meet who has consequences is Fiona. There's no guy for her. Mm-hmm. So she's waiting for my dearie, and happy am I to hold my heart till he comes strolling by. Well, the likelihood he's going to come strolling by is nil.
100.
Because of the situation. She knows everyone in town, and none of them appeal to her. So mm-hmm. within this playfulness, as she's singing to the other women, is I'm going to be a spinster. It's probably okay. I would rather that than marry someone who it ain't going to work.
Yeah.
She's fine. Her father is, the mother's not around. We don't know what happens. The father, she's definitely taking care of her father. He's fun, but he calls on her to do it. She's the older sister taking care of her younger sister. So she's kind of already in the role of nurturer, wife, mother, even without. And so it's kind of interesting that she sets that up. The second person is Harry Beaton. We meet him. And he's, his father is a tailor or whatever, you know, he didn't get to go to college. He's stuck working for his dad. So the one who got to go to college is Charlie, and Charlie's coming back, or came back, you know, in time for the miracle to happen. But Harry's got no life because of what happened to the miracle. He can't marry the girl that he loves, and he has
no future.
Nothing he can, we can't go to another town to try to pick up. So he's already caught and lost. Fiona's got it. She's okay. Mm-hmm. Harry's not okay. Mm. And so you start seeing these stories kind of running around there. And of course,
so many stories. I love how many characters there are. You've mentioned Harry. You've mentioned Charlie, who went away, came back, is about to marry Bonnie Jean. He's very excited about it. And I mean, he's already lived quite a life. He's been with a lot of people, and he's ready to settle down. Compare that to Harry, who just has this unrequited love and nothing to show for it.
Right, right. And he's stuck. There's nothing he can do. So there's all these people who have, for whom the miracle wasn't necessarily the best thing, and how were they going to deal with this circumstance? So that's the big question.
We've also got Meg Brockie, who is, I liken her to an 80 Annie. She has her own I Can't Say No.
But she's a little further along than Ado. She doesn't.
So Meg.
I find that, as an older woman, I find that very interesting because someone has to take care of those needs in many cultures. Mm. And in many cultures, those women are tolerated, as is Meg.
Mm.
You know, she's not thrown away and,
burned at the stake.
There, both of us had that same. Yeah. So, and she's a bit of a joke. And again, there's nothing much left for her either, So she's probably been around the block with them. And
she's been around the block with the whole town, but everyone's grateful for it.
They tolerate it.
They tolerate it. That is the better one.
But I think that's, it's an important, where I Can't Say No for 80 Annie is a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a good girl, but she has her little imaginative stuff, and she flirts, but there's an end to the flirtation, and of course Will Parker's not going to let her do it anymore, you know.
Right, right.
So there's a naivete in that one. There's less naivete in
Men. That's
but
true.
Yet
that's so
she's
true.
You know, it's not pointed up to get anyone upset, but if you look at it, that's what's going on.
That is one of the big differences that I would say in terms of writing style for Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe. Rodgers and Hammerstein are flirtatious. If I loved you, people will say we're in love. In Lerner and Lowe, you get right to it and say your deepest thoughts and feelings right from the get-go. In a really beautiful, interesting way, mind you. But
okay, so Jeff, that's called a conditional love song, and that was something that Rodgers and Hammerstein did brilliantly.
They did it so
they
brilliantly.
They did it, and Hammerstein did it on
in Showboat.
He was in Showboat, and yeah. So that's a way of telling the audience that the young people really are interested in each other, but they haven't figured out how to talk about it.
Yeah.
Heather on the Hill is another really interesting thing. The Mist of Maze and the Glowman, and they're wandering around. And in most presentations, so take my hand and we'll go roaming through the heather, and the man and woman hold hands, and then they swing hands and they're already touching. Well, Vivian said, no, no, no. He said, the minute they touch, the story's over.
Mm.
So he made us find a way to do Heather on the Hill without touching.
Wow.
When Vivian was directing us in the scenes, he was coming at it as a director, and he had not done musicals. So there was this chemist man. Does he understand what we're doing? Well,
sure.
He made us do it. Like, we direct that one scene before Heather on the Hill. Ah, we were a director on that for like 3 hours. And we got, and there's 22 lines. Okay, so, you know, but he took it as, this is a scene. And so we did it like actors. What's our motivation? What are we doing? What's another way of doing it? What if she's really pissed? What if she doesn't like him? What if he doesn't like her? Why is he doing this? Does he think he can take her to bed tonight? Or is he just going to take her off for coffee? You know, so we have all of these, and we do it in a variety of different ways. And we discovered so much.
I bet.
And by the time we were done with it, it was locked in. And he did the same thing with the songs.
That's and you play that within a thing that was always difficult about musicals, which is you literally have 5 minutes to fall madly in love with someone. And in Brigadoon, it's much more literal because the town's about to disappear. So tracking that arc is incredibly important in the show.
Yeah, I think he did. We didn't realize it at the time, but afterwards, we really appreciated all the work that was done on us because we were all very young.
So I think we've talked about pretty much everybody. So let's talk about who starts loving who. Tommy and Fiona, right? Their flame is only fanned by Heather on the Hill, which, by the way, I did Brigadoon in high school. I'm not saying it was a traumatic experience. I'm only saying that I realized this week that I have not listened to the music since. And my gosh, this score is so gorgeous. This music makes you cry just because it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's astounding. And it's a score filled with those moments. Waiting for My Dearie is incredible. Heather on the Hill, amazing. Come to Me, Bend to Me. I mean, you can just go on and on. This music is just stunning.
And the other, hold your thought, but the atmosphere that was created and all the atmospheric things, there's a storm. The atmosphere, the mystery, the Celtic flavor.
It transports you. Yes, absolutely. Okay, back to the people. Meg and Jeff have a little something-something. And then we, of course, have the love triangle between Bonnie Jean, Charlie Dalrymple, and Harry Beaton. Most of the first act is about this wedding day. The town has come back, and it just so happens to be their wedding day. It happens. There's, of course, an incredible wedding dance, generally called a sword dance. Very traditional, but also done within the realm of Agnes de Mille's work. What else happens in the first act that we should capitalize on?
Well, the act break that we took was different than the original. The original act break takes you all the way through the end of the wedding.
Of the wedding,
when,
right.
When Harry gets up and says, I'm leaving Brigadoon, you know. So our act, and this had to do with Vivian's storytelling, he felt that the act break should be after Come to Me, Bend to Me, after almost like being in love. And Tommy finds the Bible and sees the dates. The groom-to-be has signed the family Bible, and the dates are there. And there's seven, you know. So he said, what is this? You know, we're in the 20th century at the time. And they're in, you know, this is 1700. They're in the 18th century. So this doesn't make sense. So then he talks to Fiona, and she said, we'll take you to our elder. We'll take you to, you know, and he will explain.
So you can
it.
Hear
I can't
the
explain.
Whole thing.
So he that was the end of Act 1 for our revival. And then
yeah,
Act
I guess
two,
that is kind of an important plot point that I completely went
that's
over.
Okay.
Is the no, but like I have taken for granted the fact that this magical town just appears, that there might be a couple of people that don't understand what the crap is going on. So he's fallen in love with somebody and doesn't even realize that she's from the 1700s.
Correct.
And this was the moment that you all decided to take care of the intermission, which that makes total sense.
And then Act 2 starts with Mr. Lundy.
By the way, this is what's happening.
Yeah. So, and then we go to the wedding, and then the wedding goes right into
so
chase.
At the end of the wedding, exactly, Harry Beaton, who, of course, Mr. Unrequited, is so upset that he decides that he's going to leave Brigadoon. Now, one of the important things we learned from Mr. Lundy is that if anybody in the town leaves, spell's broken, everybody dies. So Harry Beaton has gone full annihilistic and has decided, if I can't have Bonnie Jean, then literally everyone's gonna die.
Yep.
He's out. So now chasing, one of my favorite things, one of my favorite tropes. Chasing, gorgeous underscoring, like you said. It reminds me a lot of the Guinevere music when she's being taken to the stake. The really gorgeous kind of ensemble singing. And Harry Beaton, they're looking for him. They find him, all right, but unfortunately, he has fallen and hit his head, and
because Jeff has tricked him.
That now that is isn't that, don't we find that out later, or is that
is it seen? Well, in our version, I think it was seen. I think it was so darkly
I think you're
lit.
Right. I think you're right, though. I think we see it, but then Tommy finds out about it later
because Jeff tells him.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, can you help us understand why Jeff trips him or how that happens?
Because he's trying to stop him. He didn't intend to kill him. He just wanted to stop him, according to the script.
You know, sure.
That's an awkward part of the script, but that's what happens. I just stuck my foot out, and he fell and hit his head against a rock, and he died.
Shout out Brigadoon, not really based on a pre-existing thing. So, like, a lot of originality here when it's debuting in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not only this is quite the day at Brigadoon. Not only do they have this amazing wedding, then they have an amazing funeral. Very sad, of course. This town is
and
very,
Maggie does
very
a brilliant,
close.
Brilliant funeral dance.
Maggie, funeral oh my gosh, I forgot to introduce who Maggie was. Maggie is who is in love with Harry Beaton, but because Harry is so in love with Bonnie Jean, Maggie's not getting any attention or love whatsoever.
And Maggie has no lines at all. All she does is dance.
She's like the Jean McCracken of Brigadoon. She does this morning, beautiful dance. I might pull that and put it on social media because it's stunning. Mm. And then the time comes to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? Is Tommy going to stay in Brigadoon or does he need to go home to New York? And like you mentioned earlier with that scene and the song, Fiona's upset about it. As is he, but the reality is he needs to go home and tie up a few loose ends.
But going home means he can never come back.
Exactly. After 100 years, he's going to be dead. Yeah. They say goodbye. Brigadoon disappears. Tommy and Jeff go back to New York. And there's this really fun scene. Well, I don't know if it's fun, but I think it's very clever. In that Jeff has like become full alcoholic because of the guilt that he has for having tripped Harry Beaton. And Tommy is with his fiance. And everything that is being said in this little dinner scene, in this little date scene, every single word that's being said reminds him of a song from Brigadoon. So you have these constant reprises happening every time he hears a word that reminds him of Heather on the Hill. Or go home with Bonnie Jean, or one of these great songs that we've enjoyed. So obviously he is trying to be present in the moment, but keeps being pulled back to these thoughts and memories of finally feeling at home in his life in this magical town. So then what does he do? He travels back to Scotland.
Well, first he breaks it off with Jane.
True. Thank you. Tie up those loose ends, Tommy, like a good boy. Does Jane take it well? And is Jane a comedic role? Like, is she an Ernestine Simple?
Nah, she's just not meant to be his type. It's done okay. In a variety of different ways, but it's clear from the get-go that he's maybe the toy husband. He's really cute. He's really successful, and he would work well in the social aspect of her plans.
Ooh, gotcha.
But I don't think she's evil or dumb.
Right.
But it's just clear that it should be that she's not.
She's not his true love.
Wants or needs. Yeah.
Yeah. So once that's all finished, he goes back to Scotland.
With Jeff.
Now that's cool. Why do you think that is?
Because they're buddies and Jeff has to make sure that he knows.
That's so cute.
And there also has to be a moment at the end of the show when Tommy leaves Jeff. Jeff looks back at Tommy. The end of the show, the only one left on stage is Jeff.
Wow.
And that's also saying something. So maybe Jeff is going to get himself together.
Yeah. That's promising. That's hopeful. Why I love musicals. They go back. I love how quickly it comes together, but it is just the sweetest thing in the world and so pure and earnest. The town comes back because of the love. What is greater than this miracle is this love that he has. So
it's pointed out by the fact that Mr. Lundy comes out to meet Tommy. And he says, "You must love her very much. You woke me up."
You know, so cute.
And so, and then in our version, Fiona does come down the stairs and extend her hand to him, and go up together. In the original, that was too ricey. So it was Mr. Lundy took him off.
Really interesting.
Yeah. In the movie, it's different too. The movie, she's there too.
Yeah.
The movie,
but, there's that dramatic silhouette in the movie of Sid Charisse coming through that doorway. It's very
dramatic.
They
changed everything in the movie. But
they
anyways.
Sure did. I remember being in junior high and, you know, like when you had a teacher gone, there'd be a substitute teacher, but they'd put on a movie. And I was in choir and the teacher was going to be gone. So we watched Brigadoon for 2 days with the substitute teacher. And bless this sub's heart, she thought she knew so much about old school musicals. And she was trying to tell everybody that Gene Kelly was Sid Charisse. Now, this is Sid. This is Sid. And me, being the total nerd that I was just like fuming in my chair, being like, "That is not Sid Charisse."
Oh, that's a wonderful story. Yeah,
hilarious.
Oh.
Anyway, so that's Brigadoon. It's obviously a huge part of 1940s and 1950s musical theater. I mean, Schmigadoon just came out a year or so ago, which clearly has ties to Brigadoon. Did you watch it?
I watched a couple of the episodes, and yeah. it's tied because they have the interlopers. It's a guy and a girl who are going to find love instead of the two men. And they wander in and they start the whole Brigadoon thing. But then they go to every single musical ever written. So
exactly.
At first I said, "Oh, I hope, because it's so silly." And people who dislike musicals are, "Why are they singing?" And then I was like, people are going to just say, but it's so cleverly done. And everyone who's singing is brilliant at it. They're all musical theater performers, most
of
them.
Yes,
and it grew on me, and it's very funny, especially if you can recognize every single reference.
All the references. It's so true. I think that I always get really nervous when things like that come out because there's already so much that makes fun of the art form. I want something that celebrates the earnestness of it. Like, to be brave enough to be honest about musical theater is one of the more vulnerable things I think we can do as humans in 2022. And I think that it really did get to a really sweet place where they were brave enough to do that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So a huge cultural footprint, a huge moment in figuring out what the future of musical theater was going to be and continues to be. So I'm really grateful for it. I'm really grateful for this episode because it has sparked something in me. And thank you for teaching us today, Meg.
It's a hard show to do because of the need of astounding dancers.
Sure.
And just before COVID, I was actually hired to do it and to play Mr. Lundy as Mrs. Lundy. And I did it at NYU in one of my last years. And it works. It works brilliantly because then I can be eccentric.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what Lundy is. And then it makes Jeff a real jerk when he starts saying those awful things like he does to Lundy, you know.
Wow.
It's anyway.
How fun.
We had to get permission for that, and it was granted. So it's kind of, I mean, every high school casts a woman as Mrs. Lundy anyway. Yeah, it's the only people they have to play it. So there you go.
That's amazing. That's really sweet. I would love to see you direct it.
Maybe one day. We'll see. I'll get a great choreographer. This was so much fun. Thank you for inviting me, because you're fun to talk to.
Oh, thank you, Meg. I really appreciate that. As always, if you have recommendations for shows you'd like us to cover on A Musical Theater Podcast, you can always email me at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, at A Musical Podcast. We're also on TikTok. We have Patreon ! Where for only $1 a month, you can support the show and receive bonus content. We also have a Tee Public store where any of our profits are going to Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. You guys, thank you so much for listening. You know how grateful I am for this podcast community. You're the best. Share us with your friends. Hey, Meg Bussert, what's new for you? What do you want to plug?
Well, Charles Kirsch has put it together an evening of folks who did a lot of Broadway in the 70s, 80s, and 90s mostly.
Oh my gosh, this lineup is insane.
10 of us that have done Broadway shows, and we'll all be doing a song. Some will do songs they introduced. I'm going to do something I introduced on a recording.
Yes.
From a Phantom, Morrieta and Arthur Cope at Phantom. I'm going to do the Evil Diva, Carlotta's Numbers.
You were La Carlotta on the album.
Yes. So I'm going to do a version of that, and it'll be a fun evening. And I'm putting together a couple little things. I'm still coming out of COVID nonsense. And lost a lot of stuff, as everyone else did. But I'm very excited about some workshops that I'm presenting. Some are on that, Shakespeare and the musical. I like that title, don't you? Shakespeare and the musical. We'll see. But
Incredible. You are a talent and a true ambassador for the art form, and I'm so grateful you were here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody out there, thank you so much for listening, and go listen to Brigadoon. Do it. There's a lot of recordings. Have fun. Bye.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.